You are listening to Viva and Barnes, Law for the People. I am Viva Fry, David Fryheit, a Montreal litigator turned YouTuber. Robert Barnes is a world-renowned American civil rights attorney. In each podcast, we are going to break down and explain things that are going on in the legal world around us in terms that can be understood by everyone. The audio is pulled directly from our weekly live streams on YouTube, where you can find us on my channel, Viva Fry. And although the audio is not perfect when it comes to knowledge, knowledge is more important than audio quality. Enjoy your podcast. Robert, where are you? What state, if you may disclose that information?
Back in Nevada. So back in Vegas, back home. Though I might be on the road soon, but back home at least for tonight.
Okay, now before we get into... I have my first question of the evening, which I think I know your answer to in advance. First things first, I suspect you may have seen my video from yesterday, but you know of the YouTube's new terms of service and you know my issues and others. Is YouTube working themselves into a massive either class action or multiple lawsuits for deceitful business practices and unjust enrichment?
They still think they're immune under Section 230. So because they haven't been successfully hit with that kind of claim yet, they really think that, they can unilaterally, isn't it nice when you can just unilaterally change your contract overnight? Wouldn't we all like to have that, you know, that kind of privilege that YouTube appears to usurp? But they clearly believe that Section 230 allows them to do whatever they want. And until either Congress changes it or the courts take corrective action, so far to date, they've been proven right over the last two decades. So that's really the hurdle, is that they seem to be too big to be sued.
And we've talked about this multiple times, but we've been actually having these live streams for long enough that we've seen the jurisprudential evolution that people were going after YouTube and Google on the basis of constitutional First Amendment violations. We may have thought it was promising at one point in time, but it's proven to be not fruitful. The next is going to be going after them either based on their contract with their users or some form of common law tort, I would imagine. The unjust enrichment. Just so everybody appreciates this, they're making money by advertising off of content that people have either not wanted to monetize for whatever the reason, because they don't want ads running, or that YouTube might have said is not appropriate for you to monetize, but we can do it. If you refresh everybody's memory as to what the criteria for unjust enrichment are typically.
That somebody gets something that they don't deserve. I mean, that's the simple answer. Legally, it's that by some mechanism that's tortious, they have obtained a benefit by some inequitable means. And this goes all the way back to England. In the old days, there was the courts of law, and then you could appeal to the king's conscience. And the king's conscience was equity courts. That's where equity courts originated. They were courts that you could, the law is too harsh, and the remedy's not fair, and the remedy's not just. So I appeal to the king's conscience to change the circumstance or situation. And that's what allowed, in fact, that's where a lot of trust originated, and split title. You could have legal title, courts of law governed, equitable title that the chancellors governed through the king's conscience. And that's where a lot of that originated. And unjust enrichment is an old equitable principle. So it's not in a statute. It's not civil law. It's not a common law tort. It is more of where equity law developed a area of jurisprudence to say when something's happened that really shouldn't, we should step in and take action. And that's what unjust enrichment is. Now there's unclean hands and latches and all that jazz that goes in with it about whether you can claim equity or not as a remedy. In places like Tennessee, the courts are actually separate. You still have chancery courts that are equity courts and circuit courts that do civil law courts. Now, sometimes the civil law courts can have both equitable and legal jurisdiction. Often the chancery courts only have equitable jurisdiction, though that too can vary. So most of that has faded through most of American history. Now every court has the same combined powers. But historically, it comes from that origin. And if you understand it from that concept, then think of it is this something that could appeal to the king's conscience as fundamentally unjust? And that's where these principles originate and arise.
I like that. Appealing to the king's conscience being the courts. In Quebec, I mean, there are, I think the three criteria are enrichment, correlative impoverishment, and the absence of a judicial contract or any, explanation as to why. And for everybody saying, if you don't like YouTube, just leave, go to BitChute. Just so everybody appreciates, BitChute is not monetized for content creators. So it's nice to say, go do stuff for free and don't make money doing it, because everybody needs to make money. There's nothing dirty about that. Rumble thus far is proving to be the most viable YouTube competitor. BitChute is just good for backing stuff up in case it gets taken down. But all right, we'll see, because I tell you, those new terms of service are in your face. They're in your face in terms of what they're saying. Like, it's thumbing your nose that we can do whatever we want. We can make money off of you, even if you don't get your share of it. And there's nothing you can do about it. And I think something's going to happen. And I mean something judicial. It's going to go to court, because I tell you, like, there are people, I know lawyers in Canada who would love to take something like this to court. And we've got no shortage of lawyers in the U.S. who want to do it. So,
well, and there is no Section 230 in Canada. Now, they'll dispute jurisdiction on grounds that all the contracts require suing, in particular suing in California.
This is the jurisdictional issue is something we would have to discuss by Canadian law. But okay, now I can't bring up the super chat again because I missed it. But Robert, let's start with the topic number one. Has Sidney Powell compromised her professional standing on a going forward basis?
Most likely, yes. So Sidney Powell's background is she was a government prosecutor, but not like a trial prosecutor. It's mostly appellate work. Then she left and she cashed in on the Enron cases. That's where she really got well known, and that's where she got well paid. And that's where she started a lot of her work involving Andrew Weissman and those and that crowd and government misconduct, because there was a lot of it in the Enron prosecutions. And then she was kind of quiet for a while. She'd written a couple of books. The Trump era sort of allowed her a new platform because of hold on one second.
Yeah. And while I have the super chat up there, Jasper, I have one book in the back. It is Are You My Mom? But I think it's cut out when I'm – it's a kid's book. It was up there for like the first 10 streams that Robert and I did, so I just kept it there as a ritual now. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, my phone's been usually off, but I've had to turn it on because certain people have been calling and I don't want to miss it. But normally I tend to leave it off because I hate being interrupted. But it always agitates everybody, of course.
Better your phone than the background, whatever music system was playing the last time.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That in Atlanta. That was crazy. That was wild. So, yeah. So her background was, you know, criminal appeals, got some notoriety in the Enron. And then Andrew Weissman's return in the Mueller prosecution or the Mueller investigation gave her a new platform to access the conservative right. And so she's, you know, had her own little, like, I think it was like a podcast or talk show. I first ran into her personally at a CPAC convention in Maryland that they hold every winter. It's usually every February, sometimes early March. It's meant to coincide with spring break for some college students. And my impression of her was that, you know, that she knew a lot about criminal discovery cases. That was sort of her area of expertise, had done a good amount of criminal appeals. And would be a good lawyer for Flynn, because that's what Flynn's case was really all about, was government misconduct. It was about prosecutorial misconduct. It was about discovery evidence being hidden. And that was precisely what she was good at. And I had recommended her to Flynn's world that she would be good at that. She's never been a civil lawyer, to my knowledge. Very few cases she's appeared in. And to give an idea, even in the criminal case context, I've appeared in 10 times more cases than she has since 2000. So, you know, she's not been that active. And there was a psychological profile. Put it this way, she was someone you could see as susceptible to a disinformation campaign. I always say there's two things that break people. One is stress, and everybody kind of knows that stress can make people fracture. What they under-recognize is how success can make people fracture. And some people are not necessarily perfectly constituted for the limelight. And sometimes the limelight gets a little too bright and a little too attractive. And that's why I like all of the Hobbit movies and the Lord of the Rings movies, because they do a great job of portraying these deep moral narratives about character and how even good people can go AWOL, like Thorin Oakfield, and the way he goes. I may have mispronunciated his name, but I'm sure the commenters will let me know. Maybe it's Oakenfield. Maybe that's it. For some reason, I'm blanking on it. But how he goes nuts when he gets back into the castle and the dwarf castle with the gold, he starts to lose his mind for a period of time. There's that everybody has a precious that can entrap them into making poor decisions. And there was certain sort of desirability for notoriety and attention that was present all the way back, that was at risk outside of her area of expertise. And about a year ago, she, some of the people in Flynn World, obviously Lynn Wood, were getting deeply entranced into the precious of the right, which was the QAnon movement. And QAnon is one of the most successful disinformation campaigns ever waged. And I knew a lot of people that were involved in it, a lot of nice people, well-meaning people, well-intended people, but kept pointing out that look at the consequences of getting involved in QAnon. You quit taking action that you were otherwise taking. In other words, it seems to have an effect that's not beneficial to the cause you believe you're ascribing it to. So all of a sudden, it's okay that Julian Assange is being held in prison. Suddenly, it's okay even for a while that Flynn was being prosecuted because it was all part of the plan. There was no, the only plan was to screw you folks over. That was the plan. The QAnon is connected to literally to a pig farmer in the Philippines. I mean, it's just nuts. You couldn't write a script this crazy. But it was clear she was getting involved in this, and that's why I started to increase my criticism of Q phenomenon, increase my criticism because it was having deleterious, detrimental effects. It was leading people to not take the kind of crowdsourcing action that would have been productive and positive before then, and ultimately could lead to something like this, where you have a very legitimate questions that the president has about what happened in this election. And it's all being overshadowed by a conspiracy theory so tentacular and so grand as to be inherently worthy of skepticism. And what it did is it swamped out all the good arguments, and all of a sudden it became easy to mock and satirize the criticisms as being some sort of a tin cap conspiracy theory that involves the ghost of Hugo Chavez. So that's part of where the story goes. And go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think I might have gotten ahead of some of the information because it might be relatively new. There was a tweet that was posted earlier today, basically to the effect that Sidney Powell is no longer with the Trump team. I didn't know if she ever was or in what capacity, but she was certainly on the beam thingy, whatever. What is it? The podium with Giuliani. So apparently they've confirmed that she's not with the Trump team. Whether or not the PR damage might have been done to the extent that we don't necessarily believe that they might be able to make evidence of that which they've said they have by allegations, that might be too late. But no, so officially, whether or not she was ever with the Trump team, she is now confirmed no longer or not on the Trump team.
Correct. And that was in the works for those who are subscribers to our little locals board, vivabarneslaw.locals.com. If you've been, while I was being diplomatic about it, if you've been paying attention this week, you could see this coming. Because it was clear, I investigated and researched all of those angles, and I was wary, very wary of the QAnon phenomenon because that had been misinformation, disinformation the entire time it had been operating, taking good conscientious people and getting them going down useless rabbit holes that were counterproductive and believing things were fine when they were actually at high risk and high danger. And so once she was involved with that, I was concerned. And then started to escalate criticism of Lynn Wood because he clearly was just going off the deep end. And once it started contaminating cases like Rittenhouse's case, which we'll get to later, but he or she really hijacked for a brief period of time. She hijacked Trump's legal defense. And it was everybody that was knowledgeable about where really there were three schools of thought related to Trump's election contest. The GOP establishment, elected officials, a lot of judges. Here's a little side fact for you folks out there. What did the two federal judges who rejected the Trump lawsuits or Trump-related lawsuits have in common? They weren't appointed by the same president. They're both members of the Federalist Society. Just keep that in mind.
I was going to go with appointed by the same president, so I guess no, not.
That's why one was appointed by Obama, one was appointed by Trump, but they both screwed Trump. And what do they have in common? Federalist Society members. But you had the establishment, a lot of your Federalist Society hierarchy, a lot of your elected officials, a lot of your high-ranking election people, a lot of the Trump campaign people who just wanted Trump to go through the motions, do some recounts, but then concede and go home. Then over on the opposite side, you had a combination of true believers, QAnon folks, critics, grifters, people looking for their last hurrah, trying to make this into Russiagate on steroids. And then in between, you had a group of us some left, some right, who wanted just to use this as a case example to create election reform in the country. And those of us on the Trump side who believe that the election, an honest vote would show Trump won, wanting to focus on the core factual issues that could prove it. And in the process, make sure we apply our election laws in a way that is open, transparent, and promotes confidence in democracy. And that's where some left allies were allied to that cause. But we were getting killed by the two sides on the opposite side. In one minute, it was the establishment sabotaging him. The next minute, it was the crazies pitching conspiracy theories that could never be proven in court and would make everything look laughable to the establishment and completely crush our capacity to have our arguments heard.
And so let me just say one thing here. How when Robert said that she was involved in Q, he meant espousing or adhering or subscribing to the beliefs, not actively involved. So I heard him say that at the time, but he's not implying she's involved. It was just, you know, on the podium with Giuliani, where Giuliani's talking about stats and numbers and what they can prove in terms of they've got their own theories. But then when Sidney Powell came out and started talking about things, which, okay, Tucker Carlson had a decent point, probably the biggest crime in the history of humankind on the scale that it was being perpetrated. And if you don't have the most extraordinary evidence to back up those extraordinary claims, it's not the laundry list thing that Scott Adams was talking about. It's more like throwing poo-poo against the wall and hoping something sticks. And it's something I said for a little while. When you have strong arguments and you have bad arguments, not bad, when you have strong arguments and weak arguments, or arguments that are easy to prove or easier to prove, and arguments that even if true, you know you will never be able to prove, you're better off just dropping the weak arguments, difficult to prove arguments, because you undermine the validity, the legitimacy, and your credibility as relates to the strong ones.
Exactly. And you could see it. Like earlier in the week, and Tucker did everybody a favor, and I'll give him credit. He was willing to take a lot of heat, because there's a development, there's a Russiagate of the right, of people who want to repeat Russiagate, just do it on the right, throw in some allegations which have little kernels of truth, but which in the broad scope are wrong. And some of them are just provably false. I mean, she was saying things that were easily provably false, things that she clearly had not studied elections. She had never been involved in election law in her life, that which was a huge problem, and didn't even know how elections were being done. So she was saying things about Dominion and Smartmatic and others were in jurisdictions where they were not even present. She was saying things when, like, Smartmatic is only in L.A. County. And I know the whole history of this because I've been tracking this and involved with, I don't like computers involved in elections, period. Have been opposed to it for forever. I believe everything should be a paper ballot. And if we use technology at all, it should be as a backup, and it should use blockchain technology that's more secure and protects privacy and allows us to independently verify and audit the vote. But that should be a backup, not the sole and exclusive means. You know, so for anybody out there, I'm not on the Dominion path or anything else. But Dominion and Smartmatic hate each other. The fact that there's overlaps 10 years ago when one bought a subsidiary of the other, that she was making a mountain out of a molehill. She was listening to Venezuelan ex-generals who won a coup in Venezuela, deep state hacks. It was a classic disinformation campaign. Classic. And they were constantly making basic mistakes, putting in affidavits in Lynn Wood's case where Lynn Wood had quoted, had this person put in precincts from the wrong state. He said it was from Michigan. They were from Minnesota. So he got all of his facts wrong. You know, this is the, if you want to take apart a good, it's the old Sun Tzu principle: to defeat what is strong, attack what is weak. And going to what you're talking about, if you want to emphasize what is strong, you drop what is weak. This idea, and I understand where Scott Adams is saying, laundry lists are very persuasive to the court of public opinion, particularly when you want to believe something. So but I can tell you as a trial lawyer, it is a trap and you are dead to rights the moment you go in front of a jury or a judge and you start saying, well, if it's not this, it's the other thing. And if it's not the other thing, it's that third thing over here. And in case that doesn't work, I got three more I can throw at you. That doesn't work, folks.
Which incidentally is, we'll get to this judgment in a bit, a little later, but it's effectively what the judge in Pennsylvania did. He's like, you're throwing a number of arguments at me. It makes it easy for me to just discredit you at large without having to address even the strongest arguments, which would have been more difficult to address had they been the only arguments.
And notice what argument he totally skipped because of some things I was up to. They did ultimately include in the amended complaint, there was a second amended complaint, but it ended up including arguments about signatures in particular. You notice the judge avoided that issue almost entirely. And he can get away with doing that because they have this sideshow. And so the sideshow was going to be intensely self-destructive. The laundry list is only good if you're just going to argue in the court of public opinion. And that was not really Trump's objective. Trump, one, wants to know what happened. Two, did he win an honest vote? He believes he did, and he has good cause for that. And third, that if he can't get legal or political remedy, to at least establish the legacy that he fought for his base and to establish him to run in 4 years from now, that this last one was stolen. And that has political utility. But he doesn't want to go down the Russiagate rabbit trail. And the only reason that temporarily happened at all is because Sidney convinced everybody that she had super secret evidence that would prove it. And I kept telling people, nope, I know where this came from. I know what its origins are. I know what its connections are. I know enough about election law and elections, how elections work, that this is nonsense and will be easily disproven. Large aspects of it easily disproven. She was doing that, the meme where the person has like 35 strings drawn to different things and he's pointing at all of them and how this connects, that kind of.
Yeah, well, it's the conspiracy meme. It's the guy.
Yes, I think it is a conspiracy. There are things that are connections that are consequential and things that are connected that are distractions. And you have to be able to separate out the two. Because I represent a lot of anti-establishment people, I get pitched this stuff all the time. And half the time it's sincere or serious, where they're just misguided, misinformation. Sometimes it's deliberate disinformation. And the reason why I have the Snowden Files book behind me on the right and Bloods Are Over by James Ellroy, which is the last of the American Tabloid trilogy. American Tabloid is the first one. Cold 6000 is the second one. Bloods Are Over is the culmination of it. Goes into Hoover's files and some other interesting components. Is they both give the templates for disinformation campaigns. Elroy is talking about all the COINTELPRO activities and how disinformation works, why it appeals to people. By the way, this goes to our confession by projection theory. Go and read a lot of the articles that the intelligence agencies and big establishment media were writing about Russiagate. And they're saying how disinformation works and how it operates. And just change it wherever there's Russia or something else, Trump, change it to them. And they're telling you what they are doing. And they're telling you how it works. And they're telling you why it works. And QAnon was one big, massive disinformation campaign, has been for 3 years, lying to people all the way through to get them to not take, to use their resources to crowdsource the truth and crowdsource activism and to be aware and alert. I mean, ask yourself why so many people weren't alert. Even for the first 2 weeks after the election, there were large numbers of people saying to me, don't worry, this is all part of Trump's trap of ensnaring everybody. And we don't need to get proactive about this. It's all part of the plan.
I'll go back to chess. You don't sacrifice your queen for a very long distance play. So it has to be pretty, next step in order for the sacrifice to make sense. Otherwise, it just doesn't make sense. Josh had asked, son of a gun. There was one super chat, which I wanted to get to in terms of a substantive relevant question right here. It was, What would Sidney Powell need to make proof of the claims? I mean,
here's some basic things. Know where software is operating and where it's not. That'd be good step number one. Number two, know how voting machines work. Know where they're active, know where they're not. Number three, know where the statistical anomalies exist and where they don't exist. For example, Trump did not win California. Don't go around telling people he did. There's no one who seriously thinks that. Yet that's what she did. They don't say that they swung 6 points everywhere. That actually undermines one of the big statistical anomalies is this mysterious magical ballots that only mark ballots for Biden and no one else, up to upwards of 100,000 in multiple states, which the Democrats themselves have previously said in election contest is sufficient for a challenge. She was getting basic facts wrong. Smartmatic and Dominion are competitors. I get that Smartmatic bought Sequoia software, and 10 years ago, Dominion ended up buying aspects of that software from them, and thus there's an IP relationship, and there was an alleged non-compete back in 2009 and 2010 that got litigated in Delaware. They are core adversaries. In fact, usually your negative stories you read about either one of them, comes from the other. So that's who they are. The idea that they were secretly rigging elections around the world, these were computer machine, it was not something you, number one, were likely to prove in a short time period. Number two, it was the kind of argument that was going to discredit you with almost all elected officials and judges very quickly. And three, it was an argument that just didn't have a lot of statistical evidence for it. You dug in and statistical evidence was the opposite way. And it, like, if you wanted to discredit, like, look at what happened. Initially, there was a lot of great statistical analysis of anomalies in the evidence. Some of it was a reach, you know, whether Benford's law of Fitts elections is in controversy, but it's reasonable to at least try and see how it looks, and then you can do the counter. Same with looking at statistical anomalies from the Edison database the New York Times put out and when votes were being reported. But there was also really good statistical analysis being done by Matt Brainerd and others, followed up with substantiating evidence by Richard Barris of People's Pundit, by other people looking at what happened in parts of Pennsylvania, what happened in parts of Michigan, what happened in parts of Wisconsin, Arizona, Georgia, showing statistical anomalous outcomes that did not seem to make sense. All of that started to get crushed because all of a sudden then you saw this flood of Dominion type data that was not well substantiated that people could take apart quickly and easily if you knew what you were doing. So what does that have the effect of? All of a sudden, nobody knows what statistical evidence to believe. All of a sudden, nobody knows what anomalies to credit.
Well, I brought up a few chats where people are asking why Trump is tweeting about Dominion. There's smoke when you have these foreign companies making voting machines that have no paper trail, no physical trail. But when it comes to what evidence you would need in order to prove within a 1 month period or a 3 week period that that was the determinant factor that flipped the election, what you would need was whistleblower affidavits, not from people from 2 years ago, from wherever. Actual people insider with the code for what they did, how it worked, and sworn statements, video evidence, backup hard drives, USB drives with the information. And I've got to tell you, because I start getting the messages when she comes out on air and she says, we're going to release the whatever. I said, this had better be what is coming out in the release, because if it's just going to be, it's a Canadian company. They have an office that they share with Soros in downtown Toronto, or a Soros company. All of that can have pretty, you may not like the explanations, but they have pretty, obvious explanations. These activist groups are going to be in certain types of buildings. You might want to have a certain type of company. There's a number of explanations which are not ever going to be sufficient to convince either the public or a jury that there was this international scheme to flip the votes, even if it's true. And so you've been pushing it from the beginning, and I'm not trying to stroke your ego. It's just you've been pushing it from the beginning. The issues that would be convincing and determinant, especially given the margins, verifying signatures. What else? I mean, excluding.
That's a big one. I mean, my view was add an anecdotal evidence of double voting, felons voting, criminally insane voting, weird homeless registration campaigns, evidence of potential bail of a ballot harvesting. So, I mean, they even in the New York Times, called it granny troll, going out and getting a bunch of grannies at nursing homes who didn't really vote that way, but you just get there, collect their ballots. Same in apartment buildings, same at public housing projects. All of the risks attendant to various forms of mail-in balloting. But the easiest one to spot the fraud in it has always been matching the signatures. And for a long time, they have not really meaningfully enforced signature ballot checks in the absentee balloting context, but it mostly didn't matter because there was relatively few of them. Once you were going to flood the system with them, they had to, their promise was, don't worry, even though we're sending out ballots to everybody in the world, in places like Nevada, and in other contexts as well, to some degree, the Georgia Secretary of State did that, by the way he set it up. And a lot of this implicated Republican officials, Republican legislators. That's the other reason why the Republican establishment doesn't want to deep dive on this. One, they're the ones that have been pushing machines mostly the last 20 years. Democrats and the left have mostly been against voting machines for 100 reasons. But in fact, the machines have always been a problem, but it's Republicans that have been in bed with these companies overwhelmingly. That was what the other thing that, like a lot of Powell's attacks, it just showed lack of understanding of how the voting systems worked here in the United States. the relationship between these companies and different participants. For example, in Georgia and in most states now, the electronic machines aren't the sole means of counting the vote. What happens in Georgia, you go in and you mark your ballot, and then you mark it on a machine, it prints out a ballot, and then you take that and put it into a separate machine that's an optical scanner, and then that paper ballot is kept. And so these verified, part of the success that I've been associated with too, on the left, and others on the right too. It sort of was one of those like anti-war cross alliances of left and right, was getting rid of just having voter machine calculation and computation of votes, and including a paper trail, a verified paper trail. And most states now have that. It appeared to me that Powell did not even know that. So that's where there were core facts that were going to be easily taken apart upon cross-examination. And that's why when she kept doubling, escalating. And here's the thing. If you're Sidney Powell and you want to be in the middle of this, how do you get in the middle of this? You don't have any election law experience. You have very little civil law experience. You have very little very little election experience, period, in terms of how they work, how they function. You don't have an obvious role unless you have a super secret source that has all the secret information about how it really worked. And if you're drawn, if you have just enough of a desire to be recognized, if you feel you've spent most of your life wrongly in the shadows, that might be a very tempting pitch. And that's why I say these were deliberate disinformation campaigns. In Snowden files and James Elroy, you'll be able to spot these once you'll know what to look for.
I'm interested. I'm watching some of the comments in the comment section, and people are not happy with, a professional's assessment of the situation. And that's to be expected when you have certain beliefs already. And I'm just bringing up some other comments, like why stop in the middle of the night? Why did some of the employees delete their Instagram accounts?
Those are all great concerns. And that's where, but here's the problem. When you say the machines were recalculating it everywhere, no, they weren't, because there was only a few places that were counting in the middle of the night. Middle Pennsylvania was not counting in the middle. That's the problem. The problem was that Milwaukee was if you've been watching our channel, I told you that a sign of fraud would be if big urban counties were waiting for everybody else to vote. I've been arguing with Brad Heath about this, I think he's now the legal reporter for Reuters. He was the legal reporter for USA Today, clearly a partisan hack who pretends he's not. But he's been arguing about that. That was the net effect of having absentee ballots. And some of the states said you couldn't count them until the end. Like, oh, I understand that. But that doesn't explain why Milwaukee County waited for everyone else to count their absentee ballots. That doesn't explain why Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and Erie waited for everybody else in Pennsylvania to count their absentee ballots. That doesn't explain why Fulton County and Cobb County and Gwinnett County, particularly Fulton, was waiting until the very last moment to count their ballots. Nor does it explain why in all of those jurisdictions at various times, they excluded observers, either by hook or by crook. They either kicked them out, or they told them that they weren't going to be counting ballots and did. But to that exact point of what was happening with Powell was she was discrediting the evidentiary value of that exact argument, because she was saying all across the board they were shifting ballots. That in every race they were shifting ballots. Even in places these machines don't exist, she claimed they were switching ballots. She was discrediting the very evidentiary value of that argument, which was a sign that it was a disinformation campaign that she'd taken the bait on. But she was not interested in listening to anybody raise questions about this.
I see the comments people are making, or, she's connecting the dots on the evidence, social media accounts deleted, machines stopped in the middle of the night, et cetera. But the flip side is social media accounts being deleted, especially once Dominion is being outed and all the employees might be getting harassed online. There are plenty of plausible explanations for this, short of they're deleting their social media accounts because they're part of some scam. They would never have had social media accounts in the first place if this company arguably was if they were all in on it. But again, it's less of a statement as to what is true ultimately and what's not true, but rather what can be proven and what you actually have the evidence for. So, here's one question. Someone I brought up the chat before, but we'll get into Flynn later. Has she compromised the representation of Flynn, or is Flynn getting pardoned regardless?
Flynn will get pardoned regardless. I mean, I think Trump is sympathetic to Powell. I don't think he's hostile to her at all. The problem was Powell also pushed out everybody. So, at one point this weekend, you had literally no election lawyers involved in the entire Trump legal defense team. That is not a good situation to have. So now I hope that will change. But the and this is because Powell wanted to run the show. And she got Rudy and Bernie Carrot. There's people around Rudy that are on the board of Lynn Wood's Fight Back Foundation. This was always a problem. I mean, you don't have to follow Lynn Wood for very long to realize the guy's crazy. By the way, everybody in Atlanta that I talked to, they all know Lynn Wood is crazy. So there was nobody who was like, I didn't even have to finish the sentence. I had to say, I think Lynn Wood is kind of batshit insane. They're like, oh yeah. Everybody knows Lynn Wood is insane. It's not, and there's a reason why Sidney kept tagging Lynn. The people she was retweeting, she didn't source that documentation. You had a range of people doing QAnon type work in the QAnon world who were putting this data out. And they started putting out, frankly, bad statistical arguments that could be taken apart in about 2 minutes by competent people. And what does that do? Again, what was the net effect? That's how I measure a disinformation campaign. Look at its effect on the court of public opinion, effect on people's perceptions, effect on the value of evidence.
We had had the discussion, but it certainly lent for immediate predictable responses by anyone wanting to discredit Trump's side, even if he has better legitimate arguments. They get to bypass and ignore all of them by now focusing on these theories, which would require extraordinary proof to be proven. And so we saw it in real time. Nobody addressed certain hard facts that Giuliani was talking about. They made fun of him and his sweating hair, which really irritates me that people stoop to that level. And then they just went off on Sidney Powell and bringing in Venezuela and leaders in Canada. And so I guess the question is now, will it have an impact on the stronger, sort of more easy to prove aspect of the file going forward? Public opinion is what it is. Most people will probably not have changed their opinion either way. Going to the courts, what's it going to change in terms of strategy?
It's still a Hail Mary at this point, as Dershowitz identified, but it's the way I put it to someone today is it's a Hail Mary with Doug Flutie throwing it against Miami. So it's an above average Hail Mary. Whereas before it was not going anywhere and it was going to do damage to Trump's legacy too. So the hardcore base would have stuck with him and believed it, every aspect of it. But it would have damaged him over time because it would have associated, Trump is smart. He doesn't want to go down like Gore. He wants a meaningful challenge, a meaningful contest. He'd like a legitimate election. But if he can't get that, at least establish that he tried and got the facts for it. He doesn't want to be the because he has an excellent chance to come back in 4 years. Frankly, he'd be a lot stronger. Now, I believe that a correct legal challenge could in fact prevail. It's a little bit of a longer shot now because of how Sidney derailed things for about a week, but it's by no means gone. I mean, that now some they're on the clock on some places. Pennsylvania has to have 100 people, 100 voters, 5 of them verified affidavits, file their election contest tomorrow by the end of business Monday in Dauphin County if they're going to get an election contest on file in Pennsylvania. Now in Wisconsin, they're going through the recount. In Michigan, there's no set timeline. Arizona is 5 days after certification. Georgia is 5 days after certification. On our locals board, the vivabarneslaw.locals.com, I'm putting up purely for entertainment purposes, without any claim of copyright, what a draft electoral contest would look like. I've already done it in Georgia. I'm going to do it in the other states. Now, technically, it's not legal advice. I just happen to be giving stuff away for free that I think looks like an interesting example. And what you folks out there choose to do with it, God bless, that's up to you. But no, if people want to file election contests, there are certain timelines, deadlines, they have to file them by. But I think this is a great opportunity for ordinary people to realize they do have some remedy. They do have. And if you're one of those people out there that believes the Dominion stuff is responsible, I believe there's issues with Dominion, but it's different than the ones that Sidney Powell's pointing out, which I'll get to. Pursue it. If you believe it, you have evidence of it, you can file a verified affidavit, file it in court, and try to get at least some remedy. And maybe the court shut you down. Maybe they all shut you down. But at least it's a way of, for one thing, that's permanent record. 100 years from now, someone like me who likes to read these old court files in small rural counties will look it up and see you fought it and see you contested it and see you challenged it. Again, I'm not telling you to do so. It's of your own free will to do as you see fit.
Everybody knows, I just posted three links. One of them is the referral code if anyone wants to go to Rumble and also create accounts there because it's a good place. Second one is our locals page. Third one is an Amazon affiliate link to Parasitic Mind by Gad Saad. That's my audiobook for the week. Now, I just had a question, actually, and someone had asked earlier. I think we discussed it, and I think I forgot. What is the difference between a recount, a canvas, and an audit?
So they're really totally different procedures. So a canvas is where you is when you go into things like absentee ballot applications, typically. And so the so that's where when the Georgia Secretary of State publicly committed to a re-canvas and a recount and an audit at the same time, that should have happened, and then it didn't happen. And the only reason he was able to get away with it, frankly, is because Sidney created a circus for about 4 or 5 days that allowed him to dodge scrutiny on the fact that he lied to the entire state. So the and to be well, he lied to me and he lied to some other people, but that's another story, or his people did. But the now maybe the pressure will be back on. Now there's talk about doing an emergency election procedures in Georgia. Maybe the governor's now putting pressure on him to do the signature match check. Here's what they're all hiding down there. They have never meaningfully done signature checks in Georgia. They've rejected absentee ballots for multiple reasons. They claim it's been rare for them to reject them for signatures. I'm not still fully believing them, but let's presume that to be the case. I know that a meaningful signature match, and had people on the ground tell me this that were in a position to know in Georgia, that a meaningful signature check would knock off 10% or more ballots. And they said they've never been meaningfully enforced here. And that if the same standards that are used for people that sign to do a signature check like Barack Obama did when Barack Obama first got elected to the state Senate, the way he got there is he challenged the signatures on the petitions of his four opponents. And in Chicago, guess what the rate of signature rejection rate was? Over 50%. So so all Trump needs is about 1% in Georgia, 2% in Pennsylvania, 1% in Arizona, 2% in Nevada. And boom, you can't certify electors from any of those states. And if you can't, going back to that earlier super chat question, the goal isn't to buy out time. The goal is if you don't know who won, Trump would be fine with a revote, but that's unlikely to be the remedy. The constitutional remedy is it goes to the House and they vote by state delegation, where Republicans have a 7-state edge. There's a bunch of states where they're tied. And then it'll be up to them. And that's who the people voted this time around. So why not let the political branches that the Constitution delegated, if there's an issue about who won the election, the House picks. And the only question is there an issue? Not definitely Trump won, not definitely Biden won. Is there an issue? Clearly there is if we do a C. And here's where I believe I'm right. And the reason why I debated Michael Tracy earlier in the week is I wanted to show people, if you talk to a person on the left, doesn't like Trump, total skeptic of all of the questions about the election, by the end of that conversation, even he had to recognize that what I was requesting was pretty reasonable and that it made sense with transparency and openness and democracy to simply have an audit of the signature matches. And that if the signature matches are as good as the Georgia Secretary of State claims they are, then why is he so scared to allow a simple audit or independently confirmed signature match? And every state is. Pennsylvania won't allow it. Michigan won't allow it. Wisconsin's trying to keep people from doing their part of it. It's not the same kind of signature match check in Wisconsin, but they're not even letting him do that properly. Arizona, they're not letting him do it. Nevada, they're not letting him do it. If there's no problem with the signatures, why are they so scared to allow us to see the signatures?
All right. I mean, hindsight is 2020, and if the evidence could have been presented, or everyone is saying, you know, evidence will be presented in court, we'll see what's presented in court. But it does seem that you simplify it to the most basic, easy to understand, easy to prove, easy to verify question, which can be determinant. And we knew it because I forget the numbers now, but what was it? In previous elections, something like 4 to 5% of mail-in ballots would get rejected on signature. And this time, despite having 10 times as many mail-in ballots, it was under a fraction of a percent.
Exactly. And the people who said absentee balloting leads to mass fraud was the Georgia Democratic Party in court filings in 2009, was Jimmy Carter in the 2005 Carter-Baker report, was leading election experts and the New York Times in 2012, was federal judges, including Supreme Court judges of both parties, circuit court judges of both parties, district court judges of both parties, leading scholars, and international monitors and election standards, and the United States Election Assistance Commission and the Election Integrity Project, both blue ribbon committees, both independent, both bipartisan or nonpartisan, all agreed that the proper protocols was to have maximum transparency, allow people to view the whole process, live stream it to the world, make sure everything about it is monitored, observed, and audited. And so a re-canvass is you look at how the whole process is for opening ballots and putting ballots into a certain place. And that's the canvassing part of it. The counting part of it is just counting the ballots themselves. And then the audit part is making sure there weren't more votes than voters, for example. And so and that did not happen in Georgia either. It clearly didn't happen the first time around because you wouldn't have had four different counties report that they completely missed a bunch of ballots. How did that happen? They clearly did an audit and check to see, do we have an unusual anomaly here? So it's clear that we have elections that have serious problems and flaws, and we need meaningful, open transparency to determine what happened in the election. Also to establish the precedent that this is how we handle it in the future, to know where we need reform. We need to know where is there a problem. And I'm all in favor of people attacking the machines. I'm just saying don't sink everything into a complicated conspiracy theory that has votes being transported by the internet and being counted in Germany, and there being secret seizures of servers, none of which I believe is true. And then that's not how they do the ballot counting. So it depends on the state and the county and whatnot. But that isn't the great risk, because that was always a trap. Like, as soon as I got down to Georgia, I knew there was not a problem with the machine counting because they were anxious and eager to give a hand recount as their choice of remedy. And a hand recount, folks, just looks at the physical ballot. So that would, so you couldn't have the computer changing ballots like Sidney Powell alleged happened in Georgia, and the hand recount come back and say, no, there was no difference between the machine and the hand recount. The only places they found a gap was where they had failed. Human error had failed to put the card in for the machine to even calculate and computate in the first place. So that's what I knew. But when they were slow playing and playing games and originally saying, yeah, we're going to give you an audit. We're going to deputize some of your people to make sure you go in and make sure these signatures match. And then the moment Sidney Powell does her circus, all of a sudden they're like, well, we don't think we need to do that anymore. It's like, well, why are you scared of it? The one thing I'll give an example. Once part of the Lynn Wood case raised that issues, and maybe they, you know, maybe some of the people involved got ideas about what to put in the suit. As soon as certain things were focused on the signature issue, suddenly Mark Elias, the lead Democratic lawyer, the lead Democratic fixer, the man who helped launder the Clinton campaign money, Diffusion GPS, under the guise it was legal fees.
Saw your tweet from today on that.
Yes. And by the way, earlier in the week, Mark Elias's fans launched a massive doxing campaign against me to have me referred to the state bar in as many jurisdictions as possible, simply for me pointing this out about Mark Elias. But as soon as Mark Elias saw the signature issue popping up in the Lynn Wood case, all of a sudden he rushed to make an appearance where he had not been rushing to make an appearance before. So, and this is what people also don't know. All spring and all summer, Democrats went around intimidating secretaries of state and election officials with threatened lawsuits to get them to not enforce the signature match rules at all. And so why do you think they were doing that, folks? Because they have such confidence in the signature matches. They've always known what the core vulnerability is. And the whole campaign for the last 10 days has been, how do we get the Trump campaign off of the signature match issue? Magically in steps a disinformation campaign, of which I don't think Sidney Powell was a proponent. I think she was a victim. Unless you're really disciplined and unless you know how to pay, here's a trap. Like one of the points you're talking about, if somebody gives you something really specific factually that's easy to disprove, be very careful about that kind of allegation, because that kind of allegation tends to be a trap and tends to say, well, if that fact is false, your credibility is gone and all your other stories are false too.
Well, it just having factual mistakes is a problem. But Robert, let me interrupt you there. And if you could just look at this camera for 1 second without the drink. We are over 20,000 people watching live, Robert. I mean, this is I was getting nervous that I wasn't going to get the screenshot in time. It's amazing. Now I'm going to bring up some comments because there are people who are angry. You don't know
I'm
what
sure there are. Just as they were angry at Tucker Carlson for what he did. And we're here to give you what we believe to be true, even if it's not what you want to hear.
Well,
because there's plenty of echo chambers you can get. You can be fed the sugar. You know, this is not going to be an all dessert diet.
And I'll tell you, if Robert's wrong, and if my, you know, my initial insights are wrong, it's out there in the ether. We don't take it back and we don't delete the videos. Someone was saying that, you know, earlier you were wrong on the appointment of Amy Coney Barrett. True. And I was saying wrong and right, but not really, because you were saying you were sort of hedging your bets. You said, I think it should be. I forget her name. Lagoa, but the establishment wants ACB, and the Federalist Society wants ACB, and lo and behold. So you might be hedging your bets. You might be making two, you know, conflicting predictions so that you can fall back on the one that comes to be. That's an argument tactic. But it was not the case that you said never was ACB going to get appointed. You're saying, I like Lagoa, but I have a feeling. And so once, you know, if Robert's wrong, he's wrong. But you'll sure. see. The time is running out.
Like Tucker. I would be thrilled. I'm not afraid of conspiracy theories. So I've been willing to voice those, share those, articulate those, argue those in court, probably more so than 99.9% of lawyers. But what I know is not to get trapped by a disinformation campaign. And this was a classic disinformation campaign. Everybody started, instead of people crowdsourcing files about dead people voting, about people who moved voting, about unusual voting patterns in places where there was unusual mail-in ballot participation, unusual timing of when votes were delivered in certain places, all of a sudden their attention is shifted to searching Dominion's relationship to Smartmatic in 2006. It worked. It got all of the resources distracted. It got them all off message. It allowed them to be easily mocked and satirized. I got to see it in live time. I got to see election officials go from a position of weakness and, yeah, we'll give you what you want because we'll look like idiots if we don't, fraudulent idiots if we don't, to, oh, yeah, we don't got to do nothing now. You guys are just going to be laughingstocks in a week. So give Trump credit. Tucker took risk knowing that the core audience was going to hate him for saying this. Imagine it's like somebody on the left who are coming out and saying, by the way, Russiagate is a big scam and Trump legitimately won. The left hated them. Anybody who did that, the left tried to Glenn Greenwald ruthlessly attacked for the last 4 years, but he was willing to stick to his guns about what he believed was true. And in the end, he was right. That's what you want. You want reliable sources of information and intel, especially the ones that will tell you what you don't want to hear when you need to hear it. And again, you know, could be wrong. Absolutely. But I have no motivation to be wrong here. I mean, my view is there's a real chance at real election reform. There's still a chance we find out what really happened in this election. And that means it may be that Trump actually won it or that it should go to the House to determine it and let the people's elected representatives make the choice according to state delegation as the Constitution provides. Or maybe that doesn't end up being the case. But either way, from a PR perspective, Sidney Powell was a disaster on this. And she did probably long-term damage to her. Not so much that I think Trump saved her, frankly, by letting her out of having to present the proof in court, which was not going to be there. Now she can just say she always had it, never had the chance to present it.
And I hope people should actually fully appreciate that, is that, you know, and some people say it would have been too complicated to prove, et cetera, but it is the out as opposed to being laughed out of the courtroom or, you know, kicked out of the courtroom, which brings us a perfect segue to this Pennsylvania decision. Now, first things first, I'm having these discussions with people. The talking point now is that's going around. Trump's had 25 lawsuits, all but one have been tossed and laughed out of the courtroom. Now, am I wrong in thinking, and am I wrong? I don't think I'm wrong. Those 25 lawsuits were not all Trump lawsuits. Some of them were citizen lawsuits. Of the ones of Trump's lawsuits that were kicked out of court, by and large, the majority of them were because the issue had become academic. It was about observation on the night of the election. The judgments came out and said, look, the count is done. The damage is done. So we're dismissing it because it has no object. So that's sort of a very academic, non-substantive dismissal of a lawsuit that was time sensitive and that is no longer time sensitive because the time has passed. Of the other ones, it's been a question of standing, as you pointed out on Twitter, which, you know, specifically the one in Pennsylvania that was dismissed in a judgment that I qualified as strawmanning what was being asked for by the plaintiffs. And now I got into a fight with someone on, not a fight, a disagreement with someone on Twitter, but I quickly saw that it was not going to be one that was going to be a winnable discussion, so to say, because when I said that the judge strawmanned what the plaintiffs, Trump and the individual plaintiffs were asking for, when the judgment starts off by saying, you are asking me to disenfranchise 6.5 million people, that is a strawman phrasing, even if that is the first conclusion, the strawman conclusion of what was being sought. The first conclusion was to block the certification because of anomalies. For a judge who's supposed to be the objective person on the bench to interpret that in the political spin side, that by blocking the certification, you're disenfranchising the voters who voted for, you know, the person of their choice. That's the spin of the accurate way of describing it. So when he started off by saying that, I was like, holy cows, this is going to be, I won't say partisan, but this is going to be strawman drivel through and through, starting off with the wrong the mischaracterization of the first conclusion being sought and ignoring the subsidiary conclusions, which was barring certification, just don't certify the ballots that had anomalies, which was totally ignored in the judgment. So that is, I think that's the overall summary of the judgment. But I mean, get into it. Explain to us how this happens, what the essence of the judgment is, dismissing it on standing of the plaintiffs and standing of President Trump's campaign.
I think, I mean, and really the backstory for this, the reason why they think all of these are Trump campaign suits, it's because how they do it. So when Mark Elias was challenging and coordinating the challenge to a bunch of signature matches, and his Democratic allies were, they often use Democratic public interest front groups to do the litigation. So it didn't look like the Democratic Party was particularly interested in not having signature matches happen this year. It was a sincere local group concerned with civil rights and grandma that was doing it. Democrats understand the presentation value of those things. But yes, you're correct. The first part of this is almost none of those suits were authorized by the Trump campaign. They've brought very few suits so far. Now, part of that is problematic in the sense that Trump's campaign should have been much better prepared for this contingency. And the problem is a lot of the Trump establishment world, legal establishment world, is not really pro-Trump. And a lot of them have conflicts. They have conflicts because they often represent Republican legislators or Republican executive branch people that are implicated if the election went wrong in some capacity. So they are, and that's part one. Part two, the legal class as a group, as a professional class as a group, is anti-Trump. They've always been anti-populist. So you have very few lawyers that are natural advocates for Trump. Most of them, even if they're nominally Republican, are likely to be in the never Trump category, ideologically and intellectually, or at least the Trump skeptical category. I mean, one of the people that is now one of his main advocates, Jenna Ellis, was a never Trumper in 2016. Not particularly helpful, frankly, but you know, for now in the court of public opinion, because they're going to bring it up again and again and again. But you know, it is what it is. That ship has sailed. But that's part of the problem. It's one of the reasons why I decided to go from being more of a private figure. My icon was more like Robert De Niro's character in Wag the Dog. That's how I preferred to get things done. But during the Trump era, it became clear there was going to be so few legal advocates defending Trump and Trump's constituency and a lot of values related to that, that somebody needed to speak out. And that's why I chose to take a higher profile. But it was a systemic problem that there weren't a bunch. I think they kind of knew there weren't going to be. I started to realize why they were so cocky is that they had not gotten much pushback from anybody when they were doing all of these changes throughout 2020. When they were getting secretaries of state to issue ridiculous policies and procedures about signature matches, like the Michigan Secretary of State, that's just a crock, where she said maybe it's still a match if somebody goes from doing long cursive signatures to writing in block print. I mean, that's absurd. And yet that's what Democratic threats got. So and the fact there wasn't a bunch of Republican lawyers fighting like crazy the other way, the fact they allowed some of these legislatures to even pass some of these laws, which were inane, which may be unconstitutional, according to a Pennsylvania congressman who's filed suit, unconstitutional under the Pennsylvania state constitution, which is an interesting aspect to that suit. But so they really weren't prepared. A little bit of that is on Trump. A lot of it is just because Trump came out of nowhere, seized power. There wasn't a populist group around him. and look at the three populist kind of people around him or outsiders that had been successful in the court of public opinion that assisted Trump in some manner in 2016. Roger Stone and his group, Steve Bannon and his group, and Julian Assange and his group. Does anybody really think it's a coincidence that all three ended up criminally prosecuted? Just put that, yeah. And for those people who think Barnes hates conspiracy theories, that's why he doesn't like what Sidney, you know, I have no problem pointing out things that I find problematic. That's why I like James Ellroy's book, Bloods Are Over, right there. That's why I'm recommending it for people. So it's a template to how power really operates. But also, don't get caught in the disinformation campaign. That's essential. By the way, that was more proof to me that something's AWOL with the election. You don't need to launch a major disinformation campaign if you think an honest evaluation of the vote, an honest audit of the vote produces, it shows your candidate definitely won't win. Imagine somebody that's on the SEC saying, no, we can't audit our financials, but trust us, everything's fine. But please, whatever you do, don't audit the financials.
No, and I was thinking, it's like, it's preposterous that publicly traded companies have to file audited financial statements yearly, and you can't audit the most. But I mean, again, now the audit would do what now? Because actually, sorry, another question.
Well, multiple levels. The audit, a real audit, because what's great here is the elect. So after 2000 and the debacle of 2000, where we had a lot of machines that were even worse. I mean, we had 1-2% of people whose votes weren't counted because the machine screwed up. As we got the hanging Chad and all that. So the, and you'd had variations between ballots, between the counties. If Gore had requested a statewide recount, he might have won, by the way. He didn't understand the nature of variance, but that's another story for another day. It's not a coincidence that Georgia did a statewide recount. Let's just say that was a sage recommendation by a good lawyer down there. Or who happened to be there. So the nature of it points to it. So go back to your question.
The question was... the audit. What does an audit entail? But also the signature, matching signatures. Nate, Kurt, and I did a stream last week where there was a disagreement as to whether or not there's signatures to match, because if they can track your ballot, it's not an anonymous ballot.
Well, here's the thing. The way election contests work is they don't really try to get into a guessing game as to who someone would have voted for, because that's often the case in an illegal vote circumstance. So let's say you prove a felon voted. You can't prove who they voted for. Let's say a dead person voted. You can't prove where that ballot, who cast that ballot, in fact, or who that ballot was cast in favor of. So the election contest standards is different. The election contest standards are not, can you prove who actually won? It's, can you put the margin of victory in doubt because there is more illegal ballots cast than the margin of victory? And the remedy has been one of two things, either a revote, a new election, or in the case of the presidency, the House delegations voting by state delegation. So that's always been the remedy. And that's where there are people who are out there pushing for get rid of these votes and certify Trump the winner. And I was always telling people that that's never going to work. That's not, they got away from that 30, 40 years ago. Now, somebody it worked for, Jimmy Carter, first got his first office by proving there was voter fraud in Georgia, in part with the use of absentee ballots. That he challenged it, contested it, proved it. And they actually did give him the seat rather than a new election, is my recollection. Same with Obama, who got people knocked off. But other than, so Democrats know how this game has worked. It's not a coincidence, by the way, that look at a lot of Democratic challenges. It's when they're trying to get third party and independents off the ballot. This is why I knew so much about this issue. They always strike the signatures. They always go the signature route and they get at least 20%. And so, I was curious, like, hold on, it's 0.1%, 0.2%. I don't care if that's what you got in past elections. That just tells me you've never been following it. And a high-ranking public official in Georgia confirmed to me, he said, Bob, if you dig into the signature match, you're going to find a systematic problem in Georgia. So so there's no doubt, and you think that's different in Pennsylvania. Why are they all so scared of doing signature matches? The Secretary of State told the counties not to match the signatures in Pennsylvania. So we don't have the we don't have the cover story coming out of Georgia. Out of Georgia, they were supposed to allow Republicans to observe it. They didn't. So going to an audit is all the United States election, and people don't take my word for it. You can go to nonpartisan independent commissions, look at the best practices guide by the Election Integrity Project. I'll put some of these links up and have been putting up some of them on our locals board. You can go to the United States Elections Commission, because after 2000 in the disaster, Congress passed legislation to improve elections in America. So that was one of the good benefits of what took place there. And one of the things they created was the United States Elections Assistance Commission, And they're the ones who created what's called risk-limiting audits. And they go through all the things that you can do in a risk-limiting audit. They created the template statute for risk-limiting audits. And part of that has always been in the re-canvas in their own United States Elections Assistance Guidelines for Elections Management is you bring out the ballots, you bring out the absentee ballot applications, you bring out the envelopes, people can contest it and challenge it. And their whole thing is make everything about the election process open and transparent and monitored and independently confirmed by partisan people who have a motivation to question and challenge what you're doing, and make sure you have clean chain of custody. By the way, this is the kind of thing that gets missed when people are talking about computer internet hacking out of, you know, some, you know, 1980s movie. God bless Sidney Powell. Here's where you can actually confuse, create issues with Dominion software or technology. One of the problems is chain of custody of ballots. So here's what happens. A county will order, say, 10,000 ballots. They have to keep strict custody of who has them, who has access to them. Every person who touches a ballot is supposed to be kept somewhere. And so you send out certain numbers. Some certain numbers you get back. You give out certain numbers of people who come in and vote in person. And you're supposed to double check, and as part of an audit process, make sure that you have as many ballots in the inventory. You don't have like 500 missing ballots, for example, things like that. So to make sure ballot custody is clean, because it's the ballot is the magical ballot. The ballot is the currency of power. And you know, the old school ballot stuffing was you just, you know, printed out extra ballots and stuffed them in. Now there's some of that you can't always capture or catch with this kind of stuff, but usually when somebody's committing enough fraud, there's other things that will pop up. But here, this is where Dominion's paper ballot machines are a problem. There's ceaseless amounts of paper ballots because they just have blank paper, and they frequently will run tests. And so they'll do test ballots of the actual ballot. Well, they need to spoil those ballots because those are marked ballots. Now, they're supposed to have serial numbers, so you can look at the serial numbers and make sure nothing's out of touch. This is where being able to monitor a hand recount is important. You can see if there's ballots that look weird. Like, how do you have an absentee ballot should have creases in it, and it, because it's, you know, you fold it up and mail it in. If it doesn't, that's a little odd. If you have ballots with perfectly marked little indicators, you know, they're perfect, almost like a machine filled it out, but it's supposed to be an absentee ballot. And it's Biden only and nobody else, because people were telling me, my political science friends who are now, who have been objecting to election issues forever. But now that Biden won, suddenly it's the most perfect election in human history. Have been telling me, no, Bob, that's just a drop off. There's always a drop off. And I'm like, OK, then what we shouldn't find is Biden only ballots. That it should be a mixture of Trump people voting Democrat or Republican, you know, or shifting party down ballot. Same with Biden people. But that's not what we're finding. We are finding Biden-only ballots that are look like perfect ballots, perfectly filled in bubbles. So you were so dedicated to filling in a perfect bubble for Biden that you didn't mark anyone else on the ticket. And there's a strong overlay between Stacey Adams' overvote in 2018. Don't take my word for it. The lieutenant governor Democrat filed an election contest in Georgia saying there was a mysterious overvote. Now, they claim that that vote should have gone to them. Maybe it was just Stacey Abrams paid some people and other people didn't. That it overlaps with Joe Biden's overvote in certain areas. And this is one reason why I was critical of the Sidney Powell stuff. That key data that's real evidentiary inferences of something wrong, it gets swamped when you're saying every county in the entire country had a 6% magical overvote and California voted for Trump. The judge's eyes go like this. So there are specific anomalies that substantiate Trump's theory. People have been thinking I've changed my view on the election. I have not. I have zero doubt that an honest vote would have elected Donald J. Trump president. The question is, will we get one?
Now, there's a lot of comments going on in the comment section. I can't bring all of them up. First of all, am I going crazy or did everyone's icon always have the little YouTube play button in there? Is that a new thing? Because I don't remember everyone's avatar having that little red YouTube button, but everyone has it now. Okay, so in Pennsylvania, incidentally, so the judge dismisses the lawsuit. It's dismissed on standing and on two different types of standing. It said that the plaintiffs were filing an equal protections lawsuit, but that they did not show that they were prejudiced by the practice that they were complaining about. And the practice in that lawsuit was certain counties were given certain instructions or not prohibited from having ballots cured in the event that they were deficient, whereas other counties were not. And the allegation, although apparently the judge didn't think it was clear from the lawsuit, was that it was heavily Democratic counties that were instructed to cure their ballots or allowed to cure their ballots. Heavily Republican counties were not. So unequal treatments for the same vote, and therefore constitutional violation. The judge said that they did not suffer any prejudice. And so, I mean, are you able to explain that away to people who might think this prematurely dismissed?
Just contrast the kind of standing they're finding for in past elections, including just recent ones. In 2018, they went to great lengths to find standing for any issue related to absentee ballots when it was Democrats suing. So the standing has always been a BS excuse of judges not to do their job. And to be frank, if I had been arguing in Pennsylvania, I would have made it as blunt as that. In a political case like this, you have to let the judge know you're going to put him on blast. Yeah, particularly you're walking into a hostile judge, because if you understand Federalist Society plus Obama means you're double screwed. If you understand that dynamic, that's how you approach it. And you just politically put it right in front of him. Now, it has been my long advice throughout this process that you ask for a reasonable remedy and you bring your strongest claims. And that hasn't always been done, frankly. So don't ask for ballots to be thrown out. Don't ask for that at all. Simply say, all we want is to see what the evidence shows as to whether a signature match took place here, as to whether or not different notice and cure standards were applied. And we just want effectively an audit, and we want to know what happened. And all we're asking is to know what happened. Because then judges know they're going to look like fraudulent idiots when they don't let you have it. They might still do that to you. They might be willing to take that gamble because they hate Trump that much. But make them do that. Make them expose themselves to the world. Make them bare their naked, ugly souls to the universe. And see if they're willing to go there. So there were weaknesses to a standing is a bogus doctrine. It is simply an excuse of judges to say, oh, I can't handle this case. It's politically manipulated all the time. I can find you in almost any case involving standing. Outside of people who say they have standing because they're taxpayers, there the courts have been pretty consistent. But other than that, I can almost always find you courts that have contradicted each other, often the same courts contradicting each other. So I don't take it seriously, the standing doctrine he raised. Also, some of his other arguments were just bogus, frankly.
Well, so he distinguished. He said standing is the issue. So incidentally, the standing was determinant for both plaintiffs, the individuals and the Trump campaign. But he said even the Bush v. Gore is not analogous because that was only, and I might not say this right, the Bush v. Gore only related to recounts in specific districts and not instructions that were given to various districts. And so it's only normal that different counties have different ways of curing ballots, are given different instructions. And so it's to be distinguished from the Bush v. Gore on that basis, which not to say I didn't see the distinction, but I didn't know if I was misunderstanding something.
No, it was he couldn't make an intellectually honest distinction. So he just pretended that it was something significant. I mean, here, the point they were making was not that my vote should have counted. Their point was that these other votes should not have counted. And that's why they had standing, that their vote didn't count because they didn't have a notice and cure. And that's what the state law was, no notice and cure. For those who don't know, it means there's something wrong with your absentee ballot. You're given an opportunity you're given notice and 3 days to cure it. And by the way, a lot of it is required in some states because Democrats have been suing for the last 2 years, trying to force it on a bunch of states. So it means, hey, if you get caught cheating the first time, you get a second chance too. That's what I see a lot of that as. But the Democratic counties or counties where they expect a lot of Democratic mail-in votes allowed notice and cure to occur, and other counties didn't. And to pretend that, oh, he should have sued the idea that the notice and cure he presumed was the right policy when it's the wrong policy because it violates the law. So that argument he made was bogus, and some of it was just frankly intellectually dishonest. And then the third, saying the candidates doesn't have competitive standing is nonsense. Now, there is a Third Circuit recent decision that he could cite for that, but that makes no sense. And because you notice at the end, he says, I'm not saying in all cases a party couldn't have competitive standing. And what he meant to say was, when my politics favors it, next time I'll change my view on standing. And I would have been the one, if I was in that courtroom, I would have made that right clear right to his face. Because in a political case like this, you got to wage wholesale, whole-scale war. You cannot be nice and polite and diplomatic and deferential and any of that jazz. You have to put him on blast, let him take his shots. That's why, by the way, you need the strongest facts. You don't need to let crazy conspiracy theories that make it easy for them to disbar you or sanction you.
And it's, remind me about the disbarring, Robert, before we forget. But also, you know, going back to the laundry list, Scott Adams, you know, throw it all out there and it's good for public opinion and what's the word, persuasion. I am also of the opinion you don't ask for what you know the judge is not going to grant. So while I said, you know, they did, the judge strawmanned their conclusions because he interpreted the don't certify to be disenfranchise 6 million people. But you know that someone can do that when they want to spin it that way. And you know that that's not going to happen anyhow, because the argument is going to be, look, you're disenfranchising 6 million people if you count illegal votes, and you're disenfranchising 6 million people if you throw out their votes because of a tainted process. So one way or another, someone's going to, you know, potentially be disenfranchised. But you know the judge is not going to stop certification of everything. So there's no point even asking for it.
Exactly. And my view was that it was a politically unpalatable remedy, so don't seek it. Secondly, I thought it was a bad idea for Trump in general to be seeking the courts to declare him the winner. Go through the constitutional process. Go to the constitutional process of letting the House decide, letting the elected representatives decide. Simply show that we don't know who won those elections. And it was most likely Trump, but that's not something that's subject to proof at this point once the ballot has been separated from the voter, which it has universally here. Once that has happened, by the way, that's why they do that. That's why they don't have people to monitor when they were checking those. They didn't have anybody there to monitor signatures, unlike what the Detroit judge said when he kind of lied about it. Said, oh, you could have walked through the orientation. No, they couldn't have. They weren't invited to the orientation.
Actually, an even better one from this Pennsylvania decision. I don't think I'm going to do a video on it because it's too meticulous and I don't think it's going to be interesting. And I'll probably just rerun this highlight. He said, one of the standings, you didn't get prejudiced by not being allowed to observe the count because no one was allowed, or they kicked out everybody, Democrats and Republicans. Therefore, you didn't suffer a specific prejudice, which I'm like, first of all, even if that's true, the fact that he would say that everyone recognizes people were kicked out, there's a problem. To say that, oh, well, they kicked out Democrats and Republican observers, so you didn't suffer specific harm. Therefore, you have no standing because you did not suffer, in fact, harm. I mean, that's like saying they were alleging that the corruption came from one side. To say that both parties, including the side that's, you know, affecting the problem, were kicked out, therefore nobody was harmed or everybody was harmed, intellectually dishonest, but it's just arguing from a conclusion as opposed to towards one. It was clear from the opening paragraph. But, you know, like you say,
the suit, by its structure, by its nature, by some of its requested remedy, by some of the oral argument made, gave him easier openings. And that's where my view was, make it as hard as possible for the judges to screw you. They may still do so, but make it hard for them to do it. Make it so that they know when they go home that night what they did. And every other judge know that the whole world's going to know over time what they did. And that can have, and that's the only way you're going to persuade a judge to give some relief, some remedy. And if they really believe there was no fraud, then they shouldn't be worried about an honest audit.
And incidentally, this is another good point. Tassa says the judge in Pennsylvania didn't see all the evidence. Are they still able to present more to the appeals or Supreme Court? Another talking point. Another lawsuit dismissed. This lawsuit was dismissed on a motion to dismiss. So there was no evidence presented above and beyond the four corners of the proceedings itself. So they didn't actually get to present evidence. The judge just sort of, you know, the interpretation is you interpret the lawsuit in the most favorable light in order to dismiss. But this was a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim, unless I'm not mistaken, right?
Correct. It was solely, he couldn't have stand. He took pot shots at what evidence was or was not presented, while not talking about the fact that he didn't allow an evidentiary hearing to occur. That was, it was more additional. Like, there was a way he could have, if he could have done this the way the Georgia judge is likely to do it. A Trump appointee, but another Federalist Society guy, a guy I have tangled with when he was at the tax division. So I was not too surprised by how he approached things. And it's another sign. It goes back to why I didn't like Barrett. These Federalist Society folks are, you know, compare them to how Republican judges rushed to W's defense. Compare to all the corporate law firms that rushed to W's defense in 2000 to what's happening to Trump, where they're abandoning him, undermining him, and not following through. So it's a sign that we need to purge the Federalist Society from control and monopoly over powerful positions on the Republican side. And it'll be something that might be part of an objective over the next 4 years. And this might provide particular good political evidence in support of it. But yes, you're right. He didn't. As to whether evidence can be heard, they can look at the under. They have to presume all the evidence is true for the purposes of appeal. Because that this was a rule, this was a Rule 11 motion to dismiss, or I think that was the rule they filed on. Just a motion to dismiss that has to assume all facts are true, which, by the way, made it problematic for him to then take pot shots at facts.
It's the same thing. It's the same MO that the judge in Michigan did. He's dismissing it on a technicality that the relief for injunctive relief is not required because there's other remedies, while also undermining the evidence that, I mean, he at least he heard it in Michigan because they didn't hear actual evidence. They just read the proceedings. And someone just asked, and I guess a lot of people are asking, you've said it a few times, but what does Trump have to do? Courts are not going to decide. So what does he have to do to get this to be a political resolution? Does he have to hold up the votes through litigation? Does he have to show enough anomaly in order for the states to say we can't certify because there's enough anomalies? And if so, how does he have to go about showing those anomalies or proving them?
Almost all the states have an election contest proceeding, a little bit more complicated in Wisconsin, but Pennsylvania has an election contest proceeding. It just has to be filed by tomorrow. And Georgia has an election contest proceeding. Arizona has an election contest proceeding. There's already a election contest proceeding on behalf of the Trump campaign filed in Nevada. And he just needs for the Electoral College to not have 270, for Biden not to have more than 270 votes. Now, that can happen by them not certifying electors. That can the court saying you can't do it because the election's in doubt. It goes to I put up on our locals board, the vivabarneslaw.locals.com, the link in the description below. I'm learning.
I'll post it right now. All three links. Just a repost.
Yeah, but it goes to the whole election contest process. So it's really pre-election is when you're filing federal and state courts to deal with the pre-election certification process. Those suits are frankly are often unsuccessful. That's not normal. So the media trying to make a big deal out of that doesn't really mean anything. And honestly, if we had an honest court system, you shouldn't be at 34-1. You know, they think this is good. And I think they don't understand how at least Trump world's going to interpret that as, oh, our judiciary is really that corrupt. that somehow 34 out of 35 challenges weren't good. There weren't two out of 35 that were good. They don't sit there and say, oh, judges are neutral arbiters who have determined that we are all full of it. That's not how they're going to interpret that. And they're right to be skeptical. Just simply the risk of human error makes it so. But that's part one. Part two, the next challenge is post certification. And once there's certification by elected officials, then you can file election contests. Often the certification is the trigger. Pennsylvania is the only exception. Pennsylvania, you have to file suit 20 days within election day. But and there's a few others, Tennessee and some other places that don't matter for this purpose. But in Arizona and in Georgia, they've already filed it in Nevada. In Arizona and in Georgia and in Michigan, you can file it usually within 5 days, sometimes 10 days of whenever their certification. So that challenge, all you have to say, and like I said, I'll have, there's templated of a Georgia one that's up on the board. I'll put some other templates up there. Let's not use the word template. We'll call them exemplars that other people may happen to choose to use. And I'm just asserting I'm abandoning publicly all copyright claim to it.
People can find it by Googling it. So it's condensing information.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. One, just providing public access to the court system that the Constitution provides for, and how you choose to use it is up to you. But it's real simple how you can file. Anyone can file an election contest. Now, Pennsylvania, it requires 100 people to join it, 5 people to swear verified affidavits. But in Arizona and Georgia, just one person does a verified affidavit, and they can contest the election themselves.
Craig Lino says, can the Supreme Court order a complete canvas audit? I mean, I guess I'll just finish the question. Sorry. Recount of all the states in question, or will it be too late by the time it gets to them?
They always can. Frankly, they should have got involved prior to the election to put a stop to all this nonsense, which they could have done. But Barrett decided, oh, it'd be so confusing and so difficult for me to come up to speed, even though I'm the smartest justice ever, according to all her Federalist Society friends. So I'm going to be bitter about that for a while, because we're in this disaster because Barrett took a walk like some of us said she would do. So the Supreme Court can get active anytime they want. Now, to one of the locals' questions and other questions that we got in, the reassignment of justices by circuit has no significance at all. It used to have significance back in the old days. In fact, the word circuit, the reason why we have circuit courts is Supreme Court justices used to ride circuit and actually even presided over trials back in the day. That's what part of what led to Samuel Chase being impeached, actually, not convicted, but impeached. And then over time, we designed and developed actual circuit courts, but it reflected that old historic language. And the Supreme Court justices would be assigned to each circuit. And once we had more than 9 circuits, they would be assigned to multiple circuits in some instances. And they often actually made their own rulings. So you'll have great rulings on like bail and other issues from justices like Black, justice like Douglas, who was one of the first people to really go after all the problems with illicit wire intercepts that created, end up leading to federal legislation that modified that. But beginning, particularly in the 80s under Rehnquist, the even though they ride circuit and they're the first one that gets an emergency injunction hearing in particular, or a bail request or something like that, something that's outside of the petition for cert process, now they no longer rule on it. It's very rare. Alito did do some rulings on Pennsylvania, but that wasn't very rare. For the most part, what they do is they refer it to the whole court. So effectively, which justice is assigned to which circuit now mostly doesn't mean anything. There's a small chance it will mean something in this election contest, but it's highly unlikely. Any substantive decision is going to be referred to the whole court.
All right. Now let me just get something. So Robert, I'm going to do some questions that we got on locals. Then I have the one question. I ask it first. The lawyer who says that he's filed ethical complaints against Giuliani in multiple districts. For anybody who doesn't know, I don't know who this lawyer is from a hole in the wall. I just saw your tweet. I read his tweet. This guy says he's filing ethics complaints against Giuliani for his representation of Trump because he's trying to undermine democracy, blah, blah, blah. And then I said, dude, first of all, you're setting the road for someone to use this strategy against you in the future. But I think you're probably the one violating your code of ethics by weaponizing an ethics complaint against a lawyer who is lawfully representing their client. Who's the guy? And I mean, give us your lowdown.
He's not just a lawyer. He's a Democratic congressman from New Jersey. So he has real stature.
Oh boy.
So lucky for Rudy, he's not licensed in New Jersey. But the problem is the left has been weaponizing every resource they have access to, whether that's college admissions or human resources within companies or advertising policies or cancel culture in general. They're just weaponizing anything they can to not allow dissidents to have any voice whatsoever and to pay a price if they do. And the fact, I mean, that's why Mark Elias's friends were trying to, were doing a mass campaign to have people call in and make false bar complaints against me in mass, figuring that some volume of them would get through. And the other reason they have confidence in this is most of the state bars are run by people on the left who share those views. And so I've represented people dealing with state bar, and that's just a practical reality of it. I mean, they have a political bias that everybody can see and witness and experience. So it's the only reason why he would even dare do this. But it shows you the problematic aspect of the professional class trying to weaponize every position of power they have to quash all dissidents and to punish them. Now, the system does this. I mean, I've been attacked by everybody, federal judges, state judges, U.S. marshals, rogue agents, rogue FBI agents, rogue IRS agents, you know, you name it. And because that's how the system immediately responds to anyone contesting what they want to have happen. Trying to utilize power against the powerful leads that if you're the one doing so, you don't get thanked for throwing a rock at Goliath's head. So they instead try to send Goliath to squash you. So it is very unfortunate, very disturbing, very unsettling. The Michigan Attorney General saying she's going to weaponize her position of power to go after Republicans if they don't do what she wants them to do in the Republican state legislature about the election. I mean, so if they call for an audit of the election before certification, she's threatening them with criminal prosecution. Jonathan Turley has been detailing how horrendous this is, but the media has been completely quiet about all of it.
And now apparently someone says Powell's Twitter account has been suspended. That's the second comment I've seen to that effect tonight. fake news says Powell was removed. Okay. Conflicting information. All right. Let's get to some of the questions from locals. Locals question. Let's assume for the sake of argument that Joe Biden is inaugurated on January 20th. Then continuing investigations find incontrovertible, provable, overwhelming evidence that the election was fraudulent and Trump did indeed win. Can the Supreme Court overturn the first result and reinstate Trump? Or is there no recourse or remedy for this?
The only constitutional remedy would be impeachment and conviction.
And
but they couldn't put Trump in. Okay, that can't happen until the 2024.
So even impeachment conviction would result in Kamala Harris being the president. You wouldn't be able to impeach her on this election fraud because presumably she'd have nothing to do with it. Okay, that's very interesting. I'm going to bring up this super chat while I bring up another one. That'll answer a lot of questions for people. So if it gets past January 20th, nobody puts Trump back in power, even if there was fraud. It'll be a system overhaul. It'll be eye-opening. It'll be potentially debilitating to democracy in the United States. It might even be debilitating to the standing of the United States on a global scale.
Or it could be Andrew Jackson. You know, Andrew Jackson had stolen from him in 1824. That led to the creation of a party who the Jacksonians would vote for almost the next 200 years. So it institutionalized and it strengthened the populist movement in America. And that's my hope here, is that even if there's not relief or remedy from either courts or Congress, that it enlightens, educates, and engages a real populist movement in the country that has deeper roots and wider, broader roots that ultimately can make meaningful institutional reform happen in ways that would not have happened, frankly, even if Trump had been reelected. He would have been hamstrung in a lot of ways.
And I'm bringing this up here. Disputed information. The fact is the fact. We'll see you later. Okay. Locals question two. Is Bill Barr on vacation? Where the heck is the FBI?
Good question. They're usually busy trying to entrap young kids into boosting the Democratic candidate in Michigan by suggesting the poor little governor was the victim. This tyrant governor, Governor Whitmore, was somehow the victim of a plot of a bunch of YouTubers when really they were the victims of an entrapment by the FBI. They've been too busy doing that rather than actually doing any investigation into any election fraud anywhere in the country of any consequence.
Okay, interesting. I'm going to bring up some super chats while we do that. The question three from locals. What is the legal basis to submit statistical analysis to the courts? This is actually going to answer another bunch of questions I saw in the super chat. Do I read the rest of this? Courts have accepted statistical voter fraud in the past. Why is it different now? 1990s under Janet Reno saw statistical analysis to infer racial discrimination. How do the courts view, vet, accept, reject simple statistics as evidence to allow grand juries, et cetera, et cetera?
And they absolutely continually do statistical evidence. So it just depends on the quality of the statistical evidence. But the statistical evidence is often the only evidence to support either recount or election contest litigation. Because the key evidence, at least at the initial stage, because the key evidence will only be in the possession of the government, as Jonathan Turley pointed out. So that you always start off with, and statistical evidence has been accepted repeatedly as at least enough to get a prima facie proof of something to get further discovery.
All right, I'm bringing up Cleopatra asked the question twice, so I have to make sure we get it. Viva, so again, you and Barnes are saying there's no path to 270 for Trump. What are your takes on our chances for any sense of freedom ever again? Second half, I cannot answer. First half, Robert?
Well, there's definitely a chance if it goes to the House. That's just the way we resolve it. In other words, when we have an election that because the way it was handled, we cannot know for certain the winner because the ballots have been separated from the voter. The remedy is to go to the House. And if it goes to the House, logically, they would vote Trump in because it's a seven state edge, I believe, for then that includes some split states, but for Republicans in the state delegation. So and each delegation gets a vote. So if we do the constitutional remedy and if we get an honest vote count, then Trump will be the next president. Now, at this point, the question is, what's the probability of getting that? You're going up. You have to rely on two different bodies, courts and Congress, who have historically not been friends to Trump or friends to populism or friends, honestly, to constitutional honesty in times like this. So that's your obstacle. That's your hurdle. But by no means is it impossible. It may be a long shot. Like I said, a Hail Mary, but a Hail Mary with Doug Flutie at the 49-yard line. So we'll see how it goes.
Someone in the contract in the comment section said Doug Flutie sucked, but I don't know enough about football.
Miami still remembers that.
So we got, this is going back to Shiva's blog, and a few people have asked it, and it's sort of one of the questions indirectly in the locals questions. What do you make of Dr. Shiva's analysis?
There's a explanation of it that others have provided that make it, you know, a decent evidence, but not necessarily the most persuasive evidence. So it's the sometimes there are some of the affidavits that I've seen filed in different ones where people are shocked that there's more than 90% of the vote in a precinct would go for Biden in a county where Trump never gets 90%. That happens all the time. That's urban areas. African-American precincts tend to vote 90% plus. West LA, Venice, I think now votes 90% plus. So sometimes that analysis is done in a way that because of how they counted absentee ballots, they created these statistical patterns that are historically unprecedented. The argument is that just happened to be how those ballots were from those locations. And that is a possible explanation. So the mere existence of a statistical anomaly does not mean persuasive evidence of fraud. It's just an indicia of reasons to look further into what happened. Now, here's where it could be. If you have very similar demographics and in groups that historically politically vote together, like, say, North Fulton County and Southern Cherokee County and around Atlanta, and suddenly there's a 10 to 15 point divergence, that can be evidence of a problem. And if you track it to, like Matt Brainerd's trying to do, large numbers of votes going to a post office box where they claim they live, well, then you got some more questions going on.
All right, I'll finish with this one because we want to deal with one topic before I get bombarded by children upstairs. Locals question, how come, and this is one that a lot of people in this comment section are asking as well, because people are discouraged and they are, exhausted. How can we, the people, actively fight for our rights beyond voting? Ideas I have include volunteering as a poll worker, vote counter watcher donating to an election integrity project, like something People's Pundit seems to be hinting at. I'll skip the rest of that and merge it with the next question. What can people do? And why are the judges not more shocked and appalled at what is objectively poll watchers having been denied to be able to effectively do what they are lawfully required and compelled to do?
Because what judges are mostly there for is to cover for institutional corruption, not expose it. That's the unfortunate reality of how they get chosen. Look at their backgrounds before they get chosen. You don't see a bunch of people that have spent their careers exposing corruption. You usually see people that have been neck deep in that corruption. That's why the judges. But I would say that I see this as a great opportunity, like whatever role I may have in the next several weeks, I'm going to find a way to probably have the Free America Law Center help support it, a group I helped co-found. Election reform litigation. So, you know, if lots of people bring election contests, that's a great thing by itself. That's unleashing the power of the individual to challenge the system. How many people can the system shut down and shut out? How many people can the system keep in the dark? And then what we do is we spend the next 4 years building reforms to the election laws so this can't happen again. Reforms to our election structures so that it's more transparent and more open, no matter what happens in an election, and building the networks, like all the things she identified, all those are great. Becoming a poll watcher, becoming a poll observer, becoming a poll monitor, asking to use, like the other thing I will be doing on the locals board is I'll provide exemplars of things like Open Records Act request in Georgia, the various sunshine laws where you can get the records of the communications that took place. If you don't like Dominion and things about it, there's ways you can investigate into all the communications and conversations that have taken place between state officials and those officials. Ways you can dig into finding out why they rejected ballots or didn't reject ballots in certain areas. Getting like your local county, you get the digital records. In Georgia, all the ballots are scanned, which means they should be able to produce to you on a little USB drive every ballot in the state of Georgia. And you can use the Open Records Act request to get them all. So you can look at them yourself. And figure out, hey, these are weird ballots. And hey, these numbers don't really work. So we can crowdsource and redemocratize our elections. And we should use this crisis of confidence to at least achieve that objective, even if we can't find all the other objectives that might be just and viable.
Well, and I know people are going to say that when you don't feel that your competitor's playing fairly, thinking that you're going to just play more fairly by the rules is not the most, in their minds, not necessarily the most plausible or the most realistic line of victory. But like I say, you can't become that which you despise in your fight against it. So that's the tough thing.
You'll be careful when you look at the monster not to become the monster. Or don't be Nixon. Nixon felt so betrayed by what happened in 1960 that led to Watergate. So the he became so obsessed that he was never going to get out cheated again that he cheated himself of the presidency. So there's ways to – the remedy is not to go darker and dirtier than the other side. The remedy is to use the democratic powers we have available to us to bring more light to the world.
Okay, and I think we've exhausted this discussion until further news, which we're certainly going to have, this week. Let me just get this off here. Now, the question that first of all, we should end with this because we don't have much time left anyhow.
Candace Owens,
say it again.
Candace Owens.
Oh well, okay. I didn't read the lawsuit in its entirety. I skimmed through it, but Candace Owens has filed. It effectively looks like a defamation lawsuit because of fact-checking that Facebook had through its third-party affiliate or whatever, its third-party partner fact-checker, and fact-check something that Candace Owens says, which she is now saying by virtue of that, it's defamatory and causing prejudice and all the stuff. I didn't read it in any detail enough to give any more of a synopsis than that, but that Rittenhouse and then that's it. But yeah, what do you think of Candace Owens' lawsuit and her chances of success?
So I think parts of it, I mean, she filed in state court in Delaware, because her company is based there. I guess she lives there. I didn't realize that. She sued the USA Today and another group that was the lead fact-checking groups for Facebook. And the question really will come down to, and she sued under a variety of tort theories under which the underlying tort is defamation, but she's suing for, you know, tortious interference with prospective economic relationships, so on and so forth, tortious interference with an existing contract, and the rest. But she would need to win on defamation, and First Amendment law applies to all of it. The key is they labeled her false. And the question is that a factual statement or a protected opinion? And that will be where it hinges. Her lawyers include Todd McMurdy from Kentucky, who ran against Thomas Massey and who I have had some dealings with and not a fan of. So I think she could have picked better counsel. I'll put it that way. The other counsel is Greta Van Susteren's husband, who is a longtime Democrat, as far as I knew, but he's also a Scientologist. That's, you know, you do that, do with that what you want. I would have picked some different counsel. That's all I'll say on that side. But the suit itself appears to be pretty well drafted. It just doesn't do a full enough job of explaining why this is a factual claim and has some conclusory allegations that could have been fleshed out some more. But it's big. Now, she's suing him for $50 million. But it's a little bit different in her case. Apparently, they demonetized her Facebook page. So this might be something to pay attention to because of YouTube's role. Apparently, her Facebook page was bringing in $1 million a month.
Shut up.
Yeah. So there's real financial, that she has real economic damages if she's able to get past a motion to dismiss.
And bear in mind, I mean, she has a team and she has an infrastructure and it's a full business. And it's not like, you know, it's not like she's alone and pocketing that. But that's crazy. I mean, that's amazing. Good for her. And people call it grifting. Other people are going to call it hustling. And it's a similar thing because, you know, like I made the joke a while back on my channel when I won't even say the name, when my analysis of a certain deposition in the context of a defamation lawsuit was removed for violating the terms of service for hate speech. And I said, guys, that's a stain on me. Like that's a stain as if to suggest it was an analysis of a deposition. Even the portions of the deposition that I showed, there was no hate speech. There was nothing along those lines. But just to have that, where someone goes to see the link, it's a dead link, and they just see removed because it violates terms of service for hate speech, that's defamatory. I consider that implicitly defamatory. I don't know that, you know, a fact check being told that you're wrong, I consider that maybe to be more argumentative and not necessarily as much of a stain, but I can see how it can be a stain, certainly if it results in removal and demonetization on a platform where she's making money.
She didn't sue Facebook. She just sued the fact checkers themselves, which was USA Today and this other organization, I think to avoid Section 230 exposure.
That's interesting. I mean, I'm going to do a more thorough review of it. It was a long judgment and you sent it to me today and it's interesting. It was interesting also just because it rang a little close to home that, you know, they don't appreciate when you when you take out, when you remove a video and you flag it, and you do, you tarnish the brand. And I think Facebook needs to be sensitized to it, but they will not be. So it's interesting. To be continued, we're going to follow that. There was another lawsuit that was particularly interesting. I forget it now. So let's end with the Rittenhouse update. So he posted 2 million bond. He is out.
Which is great to see. It's great to see. Apparently the MyPillow guy and Ricky Schroeder came in with some big contributions. And so he was out. I mean, I think now five, six, I don't know how much, a lot of money appears to have been raised. Originally, Lynn Wood said he was going to be transparent. Apparently that transparency kind of disappeared. It's good the kid is out. That's all my care. And, you know, the whatever Wood's doing with the money, kind of his. I mean, that's an issue between him and the donors. I do hope that other lawyers, I mean, yeah, he has a Wisconsin state lawyer is pretty solid, but they should add some lawyers to it. Apparently, they had some investigators that might have been a little bit reckless in what they were doing. So they need to probably, you know, staff up with local investigators who are skilled in this area. There's usually, you can always find local investigators who used to work for the prosecutor's office. So they'll know what you can do, what you can't do, where you can get into trouble, where you can dodge trouble. I used to hire a bunch of old FBI guys that used to work for Hoover at the end of the day. Those boys were interesting. They had some skills and they knew how to stay out of trouble while getting the job done in a very effective way. I mean, those are old school guys. I hope, you know, at least he's not in jail, and that's a great thing for Rittenhouse. What it will mean going forward, and I still have concerns about the management of the case, but at least he's not. My biggest fear was that he was going to be stuck in jail pending trial.
And now he's back. He's from Illinois, so he's presumably back home. He'll be out until he has his trial. It's going to be up for his defense team to prepare the defense. And let me just bring this chat up because can you guys please live stream during the next election so we can prevent cheating? I want to say something. Robert has been warning of this from the first streams that we did on the subject, not that there would be cheating, but that if there is, this is what it's going to look like. This is how it's going to happen. These are the concerns, and this is what the courts have to address. When it comes to Rittenhouse, Robert also is like, from the beginning, this is what the team has to do. Gather the information, scour the internet, preserve all evidence that might, you know, disappear into the memory hole, because the bail and the extradition were non-substantive issues. They need to gather and preserve the evidence that is out there, which includes all angles, all videos, and, you know, for his own defense. So these streams, they are predictive. Thus far, they've been pretty decent, Robert. So that's it. It's an interesting thing. So he's out the 2 million of my own personal question here. How and when does that 2 million come back, and in what capacity? If he's convicted, he goes to jail. I guess his bond is returned. If he's acquitted,
that money. And I hope that money will go back to his family and not necessarily to Lynn Wood. That's what should happen. So when the bail is posted, this was not a 10% stake. This was straight cash, which meant the whole 2 million was posted. So $2 million is sitting in the deposit. And as long as he complies with his conditions of release, regardless of whether he's convicted or not, that $2 million will come back, and it should come back to his family. And so hopefully that will happen.
Is there an outside chance, not knowing the terms of the bond, that it goes back to attorneys? Can there be conditions on to whom it's returned? We don't know.
Yeah. And that's only when a bond's been posted. So typically if a bond's been posted, then they take 10% collateral effectively. That's their fee usually. So then it goes back to the bondsman. But that's not the case here. This was not posted by a bondsman. This was posted by him personally. It came in the form of donations, which can get – there's some tax complications with all of that. Who knows if they handled it right. I'm going to take a wild guess. The answer is no. But you could structure it the right way that it comes back to him and it's not attributable as income to him at this stage. But okay, they need to do that the right way.
And when you say so long as he respects the terms of his release, I don't know how this works. Does the court sometimes look for technicalities to demand a forfeiture of the bond?
No, they'll only look to forfeit the bond if there's actually a violation, because they have reasons to want to keep that system in place in a certain way.
All right. And the stupid, totally technical question, interest on the 2 million, are there interest terms in court, or is there like a...
Usually not. Usually, sometimes if they'll put it in the bank, there will be some small interest, but frequently they don't attribute any interest to it. At least not officially.
Okay, very interesting. And now let's see what we have here. Robert, has the White House approached you? Can you volunteer to help Trump? I mean, whatever you're free to disclose, Robert.
Yeah, not really free to disclose. It's safe to assume that, well, just, you know, I wasn't in Atlanta because I like the weather.
I don't know what the weather is in Atlanta.
Cold.
So, okay, what else do we have? I think we've covered everything. We've done quite well bringing everything up to date. So the next things we're going to wait for this week, there's going to be news in the elections. We're going to see what contestations are filed. We're going to see what states certify. We're going to see what the results of some of these lawsuits are. In Pennsylvania, the suit that was dismissed for standing, are they appealing this? Do they appeal? Do they need?
They already have. It's already up at the Third Circuit. So they'll probably actually get briefed all this week. And I think there is an effort afoot to bring in some more election lawyers. Now that Sidney's out, I think you'll see an effort to bring in some high quality litigators that are familiar with this field. Nothing against Rudy. It's just not his area of expertise.
All right. Amazing. Everybody. So thank you all. I mean, this was a new record, over 20,000, and it's amazing. And I don't want to look gleeful at the number. It's amazing that it's growing. It's amazing that despite the numbers of people, the chat, there was some nastiness in the chat this week, but it's to be expected, but it's still respectful. And people are just getting some information. So everybody, thank you for the support. Thank you for the super chats. My apologies if I missed some of them. Some of them I can't bring up. I'm not trying to, I can't bring up certain comments because I don't want anyone thinking that is a tacit approval of certain stuff. What else? Stay tuned. Check us out on Locals. Read the GadSad's book. It's amazing. What was the other thing? Rumble is going to be the platform where you're going to have you're seeing growth in Rumble right now. It's good for creators. It's good for news. Bongino's there. Dr. Shiva is there. Who are the big ones? Devin Nunes is there. I think Styx, Hex, and Hammer is there now. It's growing exponentially. And it is effectively what YouTube used to be, but it's focused on news now, but it's a good platform. So check it out. No, I have no vested interest other than the fact that I'm using it as well because YouTube makes it very precarious to predict a future. Robert, you want to leave it with some words of wisdom?
Sure. Basically, this is this election is the second act of this story. The third act is yet to be written. And the second act always looks dark and doomy. That's what makes the third act so exciting.
All right, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. Robert Stickheim will say our proper goodbyes. Oh, the streams are going to be available on Rumble and on podcast. It's called Viva Barnes. What's our podcast called? Viva Barnes. Whatever. I tweeted out. So follow us on Twitter. We're on Parler as well. And that's it. Enjoy the rest of the weekend. Stay safe and stay optimistic. And don't let the weight of the world crush you, even though it's difficult. It's easier said than done. So have a good evening. Good rest of the weekend.